I used to give a lecture on chemical transformations in wetland soils, but just in the interest of going through things a little more slowly, and folks usually didn't like it anyways, I've left it out, and we covered advanced wetlands instead. But this number, handout number 6, is a figure that shows how different chemicals, common chemicals, organic chemicals in the soil basically go from an oxidized to a reduced state depending on the time since the duration of flooding. So anyways, oxygen immediately is depleted. Nitrate, which is relatively common out there, is one of the first chemicals that basically is reduced, followed by sulfates. And later on carbon as well. And so the reduced forms of those organic compounds there are, you go from manganese is another one I forgot, manganese to manganese, again nitrate to the ammonium ion, phosphate is another one, and carbon will get reduced later on as well, and you also, the sulfate will be reduced to hydrogen sulfide, which is actually an indicator, soil indicator. Hydrogen sulfide has a rotten egg smell. We'll talk about that in just a second, but that's FYI. Okay, you don't need to remember all those. So, okay, we got through the Galilean modeling, which we'll look at in Mississippi. We'll definitely be able to see some of these characteristics in the soils down there when we're in the field. Oh, yeah. There is a field test that a lot of consultants use, a little kit that a lot of consultants use that will test for the presence of reduced iron, which, again, if you have reduced iron in the soil, that means that it's been flooded, which means that this mineral soil likely has been hydric or is hydric, okay? It comes in a, it's just a solution, basically, alpha-alpha dipyridyl, and you put that solution, it comes with an eye drop, and you just drop it on the soil, and the soil itself will turn pink in the presence of reduced iron, ferrous iron, and it's an indicator of anaerobic conditions, and that is a field indicator that you check off. When we talk about regulations, I'll show you the Corps actually has a sheet, a field sheet that you can use for delineation. This is one of the tests you can put on there and say, yep, we have a hydric soil. So a lot of consultants use this. There are some problems with it. First of all, if you have a soil that's just deficient in iron, it could result in a false negative. So you could have, in other words, you could have a reduced soil, but it's not going to give you a positive test because you don't have any iron and or very little iron to be reduced. The soil hasn't been saturated for a long enough period of time at that point of sampling, but if you'd have come back 5 days later, it would have been reduced. So again, it takes some time for these for these chemicals to go through transformation. Again, it's usually 7 days. Seven to ten days. About everything you'll have reduced forms of all the different chemicals.
Do you think that you should test it and then just to be sure, go back 7 days later and test it again before you get your final results, just to see if anything changed majorly?
So should you test multiple times? What I would do is probably use multiple characteristics And because there are, again, you could have insufficient iron in the soil. You certainly could. And that would provide definitive evidence. If you come up with a positive test, then you're good. The other problem is that the chemical does go bad. I think the shelf life is it's not too long. I think it's like about a year. So if you don't use it all up, then you need to buy new chemicals. So, or you could have it being reduced and it doesn't show you a positive test, positive result. Okay? Everybody good? Okay. Other soil characteristics. Munsell charts are another thing that consultants use. Every soil type that's out there has one of these charts. And this basically says, for this particular soil type, so you first of all need to know your soil type. Well, you find your soil type from how? From soil maps. How? The website that I mentioned. Now that all these soils are online, you can just go there, figure out, this is my site, this is my soil type. You buy a set of these things. It's about maybe, I think, $100 or $50 to $100 for a group of these. I have a set of these, but I just sent them to West Tennessee, unfortunately, because one of my students is doing some wetland work in West Tennessee. So you'll just have to look, unfortunately, at the screen. But you can actually put a little piece of the soil right in here to kind of look to see what is the shade of it. And the soil should be wet. You should wet it, even if it's dry, to get this is based on wet soil. Okay? So, is it, where do you, okay, we already talked about, you need to be below 8, in order to do these criteria, you need to be below the A horizon, which is usually 10 inches. And again, the criteria that's set, the depth that is set by the core is at 16 inches. Remember that depth, that's important. okay, excuse me. Now, in order to be considered, again, we're dealing with mineral soils here. In order to be considered hydric in using one of these soil charts, you have to look at two things. First is called the color or the chroma, which goes along the x-axis. Okay? And it's talking about these colors. You can see how these colors are changing. If you are hydric, there's two criteria. If the soil is mottled, like I talked about before, you actually look at it and it has the gray, it's either gray or it has red striations, concretions in it, then the chroma has to be less than 2. If it doesn't have mottling, then it has to be less than 1. So what that means, again, if you have mottling, you look at the first two columns. Okay? If you don't have mottling, then you can only use the first column. That makes it more restrictive. Obviously, you've got some evidence you have a hydric soil, certainly, if you have mottling. The second criteria is then you look at what is called the amount of glaying that is going on. Just like we're talking about, the gray color that is produced is called glaying. All right, and that is along the y-axis. So now you're looking at the rows. And for for glaying, regardless of this, if it's mottled or not, it has to be greater than 4 on the glaying axis. So where these boxes overlap, okay, which is in this area, for if you have a mottled soil, if your soil color for this particular type falls in here, it can be classified as a hydric soil. If you didn't have mottling, then it's just going to be within this one column from row 5 through 8. Okay? So is that clear?
So you said that where the red box and the blue box overlap, That is a hydric soil?
That is correct. Where the red box and the blue box overlap, this is considered a hydric soil for the modeling case, for when you have a soil that's modeled. If it is not modeled, then it's actually more restricted than that, because the red box itself is smaller than what you see here on the on this chart. It's actually just this first column. Is that clear? The blue box is the glaying portion. It is talking about how much gray you have really in your soil. And it always has to be above 4. It always has to be above 4. Yeah, so what you do, you almost you don't really think about what value it is you get your soil, you moisten it, and then you look to see, you're kind of looking to see where does it fit in here, and then you drop it on there. Okay. Well, automatically, if you're at a chroma that's greater than 3, it isn't going to be a hydric soil, period. Okay? It has to have chroma less than 2. If it drops in here, you're like, well, okay, let me say this. If it drops in chroma less than 2, it could be down here, okay, which is at 2.5 and 3. Okay, it's less than 4 here. It's not going to be a hydric soil. If it falls in this box up here where it's basically you're less than 2 chroma and you are greater than 4 glaying, it could be a hydric soil. It depends on if you have modeling. If you have modeling, then the criteria is, all right, if it falls within 2 chroma and greater than 4 glaying, any of these. So wherever it's dropped, if it dropped in any of these soil types, you are a hydric soil. Okay? If there is not modeling, then that means it restricts you to even closer to just one column. So you have to be within the first chroma and at least 4 glaying. So however you want to think about it. I mean, yes, you can think about the numbers if you would like, which is greater than 4 glaying. That's always the criteria. And then the chroma depends on whether or not it's modeled. And then it's where that soil falls. Okay? So I could give you a scenario where you had, let's say, chroma equals 2 and glay equals 3 on a Munsell chart. Is it a hydric soil? No, it isn't. So understand those criteria. So if I give you a case, which I will give you a case on the test, you're able to say, yeah, it falls in or it doesn't fall in. And I'll certainly probably say something about modeling, which may be there just to throw you off, because if it falls out over here, it doesn't matter if it's modeled. Okay? So if the chroma equals 6 and it's modeled, and the glay is 7 and it's modeled, it doesn't mean anything. Is that clear? Okay. All right. A criteria of a hydric soil, again, is hydrogen sulfide, sulfate being reduced, and when you step in that soil, you pull your foot out, you smell rotten eggs from the release of the hydrogen sulfide. It means that it's been inundated for at least 10 days. Okay? So, and most of y'all probably have smelled that before in a well. And if you take a soil core, a lot of times you'll cut through maybe a root or something like that. And another characteristic which is kind of related to biological characteristics that you may see, which we'll talk about in a little bit, are the presence of oxidized rhizospheres. Oxidized rhizosphere. Okay? And that's what this is a picture of. Oxidized rhizospheres. This is a consequence of being in a reduced environment. So you have reduced iron, ferrous iron, and oxygen leaking from the root, resulting in the oxidation of that iron to iron oxide, resulting in rust forming around the root. So it will look like a ring of rust. That is a present, that is an indication of a hydric soil. Obviously, if you are a plant, you don't, and wet hydrophytes are adapted not to release too much oxygen, to utilize most of it within their roots. Because if you release lots of oxygen and you get lots of rust formed around your roots, it's going to affect nutrient transfer and ultimately you're going to die. So you see a lot of non-wetland plants doing this. All right. Good? Okay. Common, again, those in soil indicators are for, we look at those, if we're organic, we're done. If it's mineral, then we're looking at some of these different indicators. So common mineral soil wetlands include hardwood bottomlands like we have in West Tennessee, vernal pools, riverine wetlands that you see, seasonally and or intermittently flooded wetlands, such as various types of moist soil wetlands that we'll talk about and how we manage those here in the southeast, to depressional wetlands. This is actually out in Texas. These are called playa lakes or playa wetlands. They're wind-form wetlands, not glacier-form wetlands. But you go farther north, just, 300 or so miles, then you have glacially formed wetlands called the prairie potholes. So those are all mineral wetlands. Organic wetlands, emergent marshes and bogs and fens of the north, and deep water swamps, as we've already talked about. So permanently flooded type situations or wetlands with very, very long hydro periods. Okay. All right, wetland hydrology, last criteria, y'all. So what does the core say? Wetland hydrology is all hydrologic characteristics of an area, of areas that are periodically inundated or have soil saturated to the surface at some time during the growing season. So inundation is not required. Saturation is required. Okay, that's important. And it doesn't matter at all if it's flooded outside the growing season for 4 months. It depends on during the growing season. That's critical.
What is inundation?
Inundation means flooded. So you see surface water present. Okay. So water is in wetlands is, as we've pretty much hammered several times now, is the critical controlling factor. It's influencing vegetation and soils through creating anaerobic conditions by reducing chemicals there and taking oxygen out of the soil, and only certain animals and plants can live in those types of conditions. All right, so the criteria for the core is that you have wetland hydrology if the area is flooded, this site is flooded or saturated continuously greater than or equal to 5% of the growing season. Not collectively, not 2 days here, 3 days there, 4 days there, but continuously. and during the growing season. And the other thing is the core says in most years. So, you know, last year wasn't a good year and it wasn't a representative year. That's why they put this in here, or a lot of wetlands, if you would have classified them last year, would not be considered wetlands. So in most of the years. Now, what you typically do when you're delineating is you go out there and assume that this is an average year, unless you know it's not an average year, like last year was. Okay. All right. The growing season is defined as being above biological zero, where biological zero is measured when in the soil, at 20 inches deep in the soil, when it exceeds greater than 5C at 20 inches in the soil. That is biological zero. If it, well, biological zero is at that temperature. 5C at 20 inches.
What do you mean by C?
Oh, Celsius. Or 41 degrees Fahrenheit. So 5C at 20 inches or 41 degrees Fahrenheit at 20 inches. That is biological zero. Okay, so you have to be above this to be in the growing season. Well, that's something that would be kind of hard to measure, or a pain in the butt to measure, wouldn't it? So we'll talk about what the core uses instead. It's on the next slide. All right. Hydrologic zones. Just like there are hydrophyte classifications with obligate, FACW, facultative, etc., the core breaks down wetland hydrology into six zones, which you need to remember. The first is zone one, is permanently inundated. It's 100% of the time. Pretty easy. Zone two is semi-permanently flooded, which is most of the time, 76 to 99% of the time. Now, these are growing season durations. So it's flooded 75% to 99% of the growing season in most years. Yeah?
Typically, when's your growing season? March to?
It's going to be in Tennessee, it's going to be March and through October. Yeah, we'll bring that up. I've got an example here for Blount County. Zone three is regularly flooded, which means basically a quarter to three quarters of the growing season. If you have a regularly flooded wetland, does it meet the hydrology criteria? If you have a regularly flooded wetland, regularly flooded site, is it a wetland?
Yes, it depends.
It depends. Okay, let's say that this is the case, that if you have a regularly flooded wetland most of the years, would it be?
Yes.
Yeah, just say yeah. Yeah. Why? Because what's our cutoff? 5%, yeah. So we haven't gotten down to 5% yet. A seasonally flooded wetland is 12.6 to 25%. Okay. In fact, it is guaranteed that if you are in hydrologic zones 1 through 4, you are a wetland. You meet the wetland hydrology criteria. Actually, you are a wetland. If you're flooded over 12.5% of the growing season, that's what we started off with, you're a wetland. Don't need to look any longer. Okay? Period. What's that? Well, 12.5% is if you know that you have water out there in most of the years over 12.5% of the growing season, then it is going to be a wetland. You don't even have to look at the other criteria. It's when you get down to less than 12% that you really need to look at the other criteria. Okay, so if we're between 5 and 12.5%, this zone 5 is called irregularly flooded. Okay, if you fall in this category, boom, yes, you meet the hydrology criteria. So irregularly flooded wetlands meet the hydrology criteria, but they may or may not be a wetland. So irregularly flooded sites meet the hydrology criteria, but they may or may not be a wetland because they still need to meet soils and veg. Is that clear? Again, zones one, if you're a site that has zones 1 through 4, either of those, any of those durations, you're automatically a wetland. If you're intermittently flooded, you're not. Done. You don't even have to look at anything else either because you're not meeting hydrology. Yeah?
Would that be one of the first things you try and test for because of the fact that it would determine so much, or would it, because it involves duration, would it be hard to test for it?
That's a good question. So is it the first thing that you test, or is it also a challenge? You're right on both of those. If you know what the growing season duration flooding is, then it gives you all the power in the world to ultimately delineate a wetland. But remember, wetland delineation is about the edge of a wetland. So you might know, okay, yeah, well, I know that it's out there for more than 5% of the growing season, but at some point it isn't out there 5% as you go up that slope. So that's what makes it a little more challenging, and that's where you're often having to look at that transition zone to cut to delineate the edge, okay? You really need to bring in all these other characteristics. Yeah?
Percentages out of the year, right?
Yeah, out of the growing season. Just the growing season.
How could you figure out the difference between seasonally and regularly if it's 12.5 and 12.6? How do you really determine that percentage?
How do you determine that percentage? That would actually be out there. You would have to be out there watching it. Yeah. So you would have to monitor it very closely. Now, it doesn't even... This would almost be useful in the context of, is the site a wetland or not, period. Okay, you're dealing with a site that really doesn't have water there very long. So that is the greatest use of this. As you go up, like we're talking about, as you go up the contour gradient, okay, we have a wetland, we know that some portions of the wetland, okay, are flooded longer than others and certainly exceed 5%, you start to flirt with these other zones. Now, that's going to change a lot in that how long this flooded depending on how high you go up the contour to the point where you're not flooded long enough. You could sit out there and monitor the edge of a wetland to see which ones really are flooded for these durations. What most commonly is done is, again, other characteristics are looked for with respect to hydrology, because you don't have the time, the consultants even don't have the time to go out there and just sit and watch a wetland over time. They're coming out, they're doing a couple site visits is all, maybe just one site visit. So they will use other characteristics instead of just growing season duration to build evidence that they know that the area was flooded and there are characteristics that represent wetland hydrology. Okay. Any other questions? So intermittently flooded, you definitely know that you don't have a wetland because you're not 5%. So it's I look at these as being good for your questionable wetland sites to say, hey, do I have a wetland or not? When it comes to actually, yeah, well, I definitely know I've got a wetland, and finding the edge of that wetland, other characteristics are better to use. Okay, so how do you figure out growing season length? This is a great website right here, and this is handout number 7, climate analysis for wetlands by county. Number 7, NRCS, and you can see there you can select on our state, any state, and you can go right down to selecting the county from there. So according to the Corps, for wetland delineation purposes, instead of measuring biological zero, that temperature at biological zero correlates pretty strongly with the last date that the last date of 28 degrees Fahrenheit air temperature in the spring and the first date of 28 degree Fahrenheit temperature in the fall. Tends to fall right around biological zero. Okay? These are used as the beginning and the end of the growing season for wetland delineation purposes. And that 28 degrees early, and that's an important thing to remember. Okay? So, well, every year that changes, right? So, you could, if you were interested, just go out there and you'd have to wait for the whole year to happen, though, to know your growing season duration. So the Corps NRCS has gone in and averaged this for counties based on long-term data over many, many years and come up with, when you select on a county, it comes up with one of these charts. Okay, and this is what the chart looks like. It has 24 degrees Fahrenheit going across the columns here, 24, 28, and 32. And I have no idea why they have 24 and 32 on here, just to make it confusing, I guess. But 28, the center column, is what you want to look at. You will have a similar chart like this on the test. Okay? So you want to look at that center. Now, you have 50%, and then you have 70%. Again, I'm not quite sure why they provided both of those. The core criteria is that at least 50%. Well, to be safe, I would go always with 70% for most of the years. Okay? So I would use the second row, and here you're looking. So 28 degrees and 70%. So this is for Blount County, y'all. On average, our growing season in Blount County, the south of us, and it's about the same here in Knox, starts about mid-March, and it ends mid-November. That's 244 days. So, based on that, how many days does it need to be flooded? What would we do? 12.5%? If it's 12.5%, we would know that it definitely is a wetland. Greater than 5%, right. So, greater than or equal to 5. So, we multiply 244 by 5%, another reason you need a calculator, and that's around 12 days. You can round up. Okay? So, 5% of the growing season in Blount County is about 12 days. All right? Now remember, again, don't get this confused with the hydric soil thing, which said 7 days, and always 7 days. Doesn't matter what the percent is. You can see that's a heck of a lot less. Well, you know, relatively. So the 7 days that I mentioned is just to say, yes, it meets the hydric soil criteria. You need at least 12 days of continuous growing season flooding to meet the hydrology criteria. Meet both of those, and you meet greater than 50% dominance of hydrophytes, you got a wetland. Good? Any questions?
So it's 12 consecutive days of flooding or saturation?
That's right. Flooding or saturation, yes. That's correct. Consecutive. Not
for every county?
Not cumulative. What's that?
They have every county listed on here, but half of them don't come on. Does that mean they don't have a listing?
I don't know, actually.
They're all the big counties that will come up, smaller.
Yeah, they may not have the data for some counties. Yeah. Looking at your county.
Yeah. Like Morgan County and Scott County don't have it, but
okay.
Shelby.
Yeah, so if for some reason you were looking at a county and didn't have it, then I would just go to the surrounding counties. Okay, other indicators. First is visual observations, which we talked about. So you're actually watching the duration, or somebody's got information on how long, and you can ultimately provide some evidence that it exceeds 5%. Another way, which we won't get into, but you could learn some of these skills in a GIS class, is by combining river gauge data and elevation data, digital elevation data, to create what is called a digital elevation model, DEM. Okay? And these are two sites here. This is a USGS site, and this is a handout. This is more FYI, okay? This and this would only be applicable for rivers, wetlands associated with river systems. USGS on most of the main tributaries has they're collecting water level data every day, and you can download that data. You can then attach that to, on the back side, Tennessee has a site where you can download digital maps. It's called tngis.org. If you take a GIS class, you'll learn about this site. Ultimately, you can imagine if you have digital water data and you have a digital landscape that has these maps that has been created by USGS, you can put the water on top of the landscape. And through time, you can look to see how it floods bottomlands, etc. And through that, you can get an idea in a particular year or over several years how long a bottomland wetland, potential wetland site associated with a river could be flooded. Okay? So that's a way to do things remotely. And some of these larger consultants do that. They'll have just somebody who does GIS work. Other more just real simple things that are used are watermarks and drift lines. So watermarks on trees, okay? Drift lines like you see here and here. Once the water recedes, you can see where there's obviously been water in this area. There's a drift line. There's the watermark right there. Can you guys see that? You can see it's darker below that line. Deposited litter or sediment, scoured out areas, obviously. And then plant adaptation, such as buttressing, what are called arenchyma. And arenchyma, this goes back to talking about surviving. It's a wetland plant. This is a cross-section of bulrush, scirpus, which is a hydrophyte. And when it's not flooded, it looks like this. And when it is flooded, it looks like this. So this is like the xylem here. and it becomes, it just gets eaten away, and it actually destroys its own cells so that it can facilitate the transfer of oxygen from the leaf part of the plant above the water down to the roots, because if your roots can't get oxygen, you can't survive. So these adaptations, these are typical adaptations of many hydrophytes, especially the obligate ones or facultative wetland ones.
So parenchyma is the process?
Parenchyma is the structure, is this hole that allows the transfer of oxygen from the leaves to the roots. And you see this in herbaceous plants, herbaceous hydrophytes. Another characteristic is called hypertrophied, or another structure is called hypertrophied lenticels. And these are structures that have like a warty appearance on the bottom of trees, right down in this area. And they'll develop those, and they help in, basically the idea is that they're above, they're high enough so that they're above where their roots are flooded, so they can also, they're points of allowing oxygen to pass through and down to the roots. Obviously, if it's deep flooding, they aren't very effective. And you'll see those, though, go up the trunk as well. Other adaptations certainly are like cypress knees. They're called pneumatophores. And if you look on the back of that climate sheet, y'all, there's a whole list of adaptations to flooding. So bald cypress, the knees are called pneumatophores. You also see them in mangroves. And those, again, those structures are for areas that are very deeply flooded, and they help in transferring oxygen down to the roots in deeply or permanently flooded areas. Okay. All right. Any questions? That was all the handouts, wasn't it? Okay, good. What I would recommend y'all, what y'all do is get a 3-ring binder. I see some of you guys got them. keep track of these, keep them in order along with your notes, and keep them in that binder. And that'll help, and it'll make things easier as far as studying, but it also will become hopefully a reference, piece of reference material for you later on as professionals. Well, we're out of time for this morning, but so what I will do, the next thing is wetland regulation history. I'll start off this afternoon, quickly going through that. Then I'll turn it over to my grad students who will do the water bird ID, and then I'll do wetland plant ID. And if anybody wants to stick around and listen about an urn ID, we can do that as well. All right, 1:30, y'all. I'll give you all an hour and a half. And in the headroom. No, I think they're going to, I told them to print out their stuff for you. The only thing I won't have is the inurn stuff, the frog stuff. So if you want to print that off, you're welcome to.